And then I'm just going to hand it over to Daniel. Who is Daniel, you might ask? Daniel is the chapter director of Ratio Christi Pretoria. Huh? I mean, we got high-profile guys here. Not only that, Daniel's mother is here as well. Not only that, Daniel is married to Ansi, and Ansi has a PhD. Daniel does not yet have his PhD, and this causes a lot of marriage problems, as you can imagine. But Daniel is doing his PhD on Am I allowed to say? You don't mind. So there's a group called Christ in Me International. Are you guys familiar with Christ in Me? Zandre Stredum. So they're quite big. So he's doing his PhD on that, and he did his master's on this group called CRC, Christian Revival Church. So that's why we asked him to do this specific topic, and he's a good friend, and he's got interesting ideas. So please help me welcome Daniel Maritz. Almost Dr. Daniel Maritz.
Thank you for that introduction, Johan. Okay, well, hello, everybody. It's nice to be here and to share with you some of my thoughts and research. And as we engage with the Christian Revival Church phenomenon. Now, before I start, I just quickly want to ask, is there anybody here who might be a former member of CRC or a current member of CRC? No former, no current members here. Anybody who have questions about CRC, who have wondered about them in the past, who still have some concerns about them? Okay. Okay, I was hoping there was no hands, then I could have just went back to sit down. okay. Let me just take some time to sort of explain my approach and my angle on this discussion. I think it's pretty important to me that you understand my approach and my attitude as we talk about CRC tonight. And I'm going to please ask you to see or interpret everything that I'm going to share here in the light of what I'm going to share right now within the next couple of minutes first. So a couple of years ago, I really liked it to look at other churches, and I liked it even more than to critique them on the points that they didn't agree with my view on things and so on, to point out their theological deviations or theological errors, whatever you want to call it. But since then, I changed a little bit on that front. That was when I wrote my research on the Christian Revival Church. So, because I moved from focusing primarily on the things that divides churches to focusing primarily on the things that unites churches. Now, this doesn't mean that the differences or the disagreements between churches aren't important. It just means that it's not primary. Okay, the things that unites us is way more important to me, at least. So I prefer to focus on the things that unites churches first before addressing the things that divides. Now, since there are so much division in the church and we can see it all over the place, we can legitimately talk about disagreements and differences. That doesn't mean that it's off the table. So we're allowed to talk about it. And I think the main thing that inspired me on this shift in my thoughts and the way I approach churches in general is C.S. Lewis. If you read his book, Mere Christianity, especially the introduction, you'll see that he, for instance, says that he sees it as a big service to his unbelieving friends to focus on the things that all Christians have in common at all times. So, and he calls it's a service to my unbelieving friends to focus on those things. And I think there's something there that we need to remember. The essentials of the faith, the things that all Christians, doesn't matter what your denomination or your church is, the things that you will have in common, that is really special, that's important. And I think it's crucial that we major on those things. And then, those of you who have read it, you'll know that he goes on and he uses this analogy of a house. And he says, well, the house represents Christianity as a whole, and then each denomination or church is a room within the house. But the point is that all the churches are situated within the house of Christianity. I think that's a beautiful image that he gives us to remember. So that is just a summary of the changes in my thoughts and the way I approach church and so on. And although I wish we could always just focus on the agreements, I wish we could do that, we will inevitably talk about disagreements as well. So we are going to get to the disagreements tonight, and I hope and pray that our guiding principle when we do that is speak the truth in love. That is a good biblical principle to remember in some of these discussions. And maybe, just like focusing on the agreements or the things that's common to all Christians is a service to our unbelieving friends, maybe if we manage to have discussions about disagreements in a charitable, loving way, then it will also be a service to our Christian friends, each other, right? So maybe if we can see it like that, I would appreciate it. So with all this said, what bearing does all of this have on our discussion about CRC tonight? Well, I think first of all, let me say very clearly and emphatically that CRC is situated within the Christian household. Okay, we'll get to that later on. Secondly, that means that CRC is in no way a theological cult of any kind. And if you came here tonight and you were hoping to hear that, then this is going to be a big disappointment to you. Okay, I'm not going to use that term when I talk about CRC. Thirdly, as we reach the part where I will express my disagreements with CRC, please hold me accountable. Hold me accountable that I express them in a loving way, charitable way, and in a way that I can, with anybody from any other church, agree to disagree agreeably. Let's agree to disagree agreeably. Now, a passage that I have really come to appreciate is Jesus' prayer in John 17, where he prays the following. He says, I do not ask for these only, he's talking to the Father, but also for those who will believe in me through their word, and that and they may all be one, just as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. The glory that you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one, even as we are one, I in them and you in me, that they may become perfectly one, so that the world may know that you sent me and loved them even as you loved me. Now you picked up on the theme of unity here. Jesus really prays that his followers will be one. And even if I express disagreements with CRC, I also hope that these kind of discussions will be a very small contribution to Jesus' prayer here in John 17. So on that note, let's start with a little background on CRC, which is just some information that I gathered from their website, so it's nothing spectacular. You can do it tonight afterwards as well if you want to. But this is just really quickly. CRC was established in 1994 in Bloemfontein by Ad Bosov, and they built an auditorium there, a 5,500-seater auditorium in Bloemfontein. I couldn't find any recent information regarding their numbers or their amount of members, but I remember last time or a couple of years ago when I was doing my research, I did manage to find some numbers, and back then, I think this was in, I can't remember which year, but it was 2015, around there, they were about 53,000 members across the country, so they would be much more by now. One characteristic of Ut's ministry is his determination to build beautiful and functional state-of-the-art facilities on a cash-built basis. And then their media center is technologically advanced and depicts CRC's use of technology to build one church in many locations. You'll hear that a lot from them, one church, many locations. Another important thing to mention is that they broadcast many of Ut's messages to different churches, so they have a well-established broadcasting network which functions effectively, I think. And then maybe a little bit more relevant to us here in Pretoria is that 10 years after CRC in Pretoria started, they launched a 7,000-seater auditorium in 2014. And this place has really become an epicenter to thousands of families and also a sanctuary where all people in the community are cared for and discipled. Now, I will end just with a short quote. This is how they describe Pastor Ut Boshoff. Pastor Ut is described as focused, passionate, and fervent in his hunger for the Word of God and explosive in his dynamic teaching of it. His powerful, bold, and practical messages are equally refreshing in relevance to authenticity and doctrinal accuracy. Now, I think one thing we definitely see here is that CRC has a massive vision for ministry, okay? And also, they seem to really have a go big or go home approach to things. And I don't think that anybody will be offended by that. That's just an observation I'm making. So that's just a little bit of background. Now, let's move on to some of the things I think all churches, or all Christians for that matter, will have in common with the views of CRC. In other words, let's look at the agreements and also the things I think I can the things that I think I can really honestly say that I appreciate about them. So when it comes to these agreements, I usually look at doctrines. I think that it is the best way to establish some of the agreements that we have with each other on a theoretical level. And since we have already established that CRC is within the Christian household, they will have all the core teachings of Christianity in common with all other churches. That includes Baptist, Reformed, Catholic. That's the things that Christians have in common. So they will have the core stuff there. Now, something that I am sad about, though, is I wasn't able to find a statement of faith on their new website. Because I remember a couple of years ago when I was writing my research, I went onto their website and I saw a statement of faith there, which was pretty impressive. And I really, what I liked about that statement was that in it, CRC confessed to certain core doctrines explicitly, like the doctrine of the Trinity, the humanity, deity, and the resurrection of Christ, and so on. You know, the core stuff of Christianity. And I remember as I read through that, I really liked what I was reading. Because I like it when a church takes the major fundamental truth claims of Christianity seriously. So I would have wanted to see that, but of course that doesn't mean in any way that they don't affirm them anymore, just because it's not on their website. Okay, so I'm just mentioning that in passing. Now, apart from their doctrine, what I did find on their on the link, what we believe, was their dream. And I think that was, I really enjoyed reading it. So let me give you a couple of highlights as I read through their dream. CRC strives to be an oasis of life in this city where the hurting, the depressed, the sick, the frustrated, and the confused can find love, acceptance, help, hope, healing, forgiveness, guidance, and encouragement. They want to feed the poor, clothe the naked, and to take care of orphans and widows. They want to effectively share the good news of Jesus Christ with every man, woman, and child. Another thing they do is to equip every member for significant ministry, helping them discover the gifts and talents God has given them. They also want to develop every incoming member to spiritual maturity, ministering to the whole man through small groups, seminars, retreats, Bible studies, and a Bible school for our members. Now, as I read through this, I thought, wow, what a beautiful dream. I think it would be really good if more churches could could have a real focused, specific dream like this, if they can formulate it so clearly, I think that's a good thing. And I want to add to this, if you read through the New Testament, and especially the prophets in the Old Testament, you'll find a lot of the things that they raise here was a huge concern to the Christians in the early church and in the times of the Israelites as well. So I can say it's really a biblically based dream that they are pursuing here, and I can commend them for that. Another thing I can really appreciate is their multicultural ministry. Now, a lot of churches are trying to have a multicultural ministry, and I think a lot of churches will tell you that it's much harder than they thought, or it's really hard work. So yet I see CRC, they get it right on that front, so we can really congratulate them for that. And then the last thing I think that is worth mentioning is that if you speak to members to people from CRC, they really have a zeal for the kingdom of God. So it seems like CRC, they are really cultivating a real passion amongst their members to really have a passion to follow Jesus, to do evangelism, to pray, all these kind of things that I think is also a really good thing. And I can also appreciate that. So I think I can really have a deep appreciation for CRC, their vision, their dream, and their zeal that they have. So we arrive now at the part that I might not be particularly fond of, but nevertheless, I will have to talk about my disagreements with CRC sooner or later. Now, I do not want to waste any time by giving you a lot of background here, but let me just phrase my deepest disagreement and concern for that matter as follows. The idea of a prosperity gospel that originated in a New Age environment is sometimes, take note, sometimes, not always, is sometimes pretty clear in the teachings of CRC. And this is like this is the real thesis of my concern or disagreement that I have with CRC. Now, I know I've used some big words like the New Age and prosperity gospel, but let me just first start by saying why I am making this claim. There is a very specific idea that surfaces in some of the sermons from CRC that I have listened to over the years. You'll find it in sermons titled As a Man Thinketh So Easy, The Power of Your Thoughts, but I think most explicitly it came to the surface in a sermon titled The Law of Attraction, delivered by Art Bosshoff. So I'm going to show a short video. It's just about 4 minutes, which is just to give you a taste of the law of attraction. It's nothing. It's not a deep analysis or anything like that. It's just it's from the sermon. We don't have enough time to look at the whole sermon or anything of that kind. But it's just a short clip from the sermon.
Notice that the Bible says what is in your heart, you're attracting into your life all the time, whether you like it or not. You live by the simple law of attraction. All the time, you're attracting things into your life, good or bad, wanted or unwanted. You attract what is at the core of your heart. I know many wonderful people, and I'm not here to criticize anybody. Many wonderful pastors that, you know, they would really like to have a great church, or they would like to have a great marriage, or they would like to have a good business. But they're always fighting the devil. It seems that they take one step forward and then 2 steps back. They just never progress consistently in this great life that God promises. Again, I want to say 3 John verse 2, God says, Beloved, I wish above all things, my highest desire for you is that you may prosper and be in health as your soul prospers. It's God's will for you to experience this good life. I see many pastors that will pray for hours. And I'm talking about pastors because those are some of the people, not the only people. Because sometimes I like to hang out with sinners more. Because sometimes sinners are freer than pastors. Shouldn't be that way. Because it seems that the longer people get saved, if they don't walk with Jesus and they don't strengthen their core, they become religious. They lose something on the inside. So they're not an attractive person any longer. They don't attract the goodness and the mercy and the good things of God in their life. They now think they live by their works and what they have done. And really the law of attraction simply is the grace of God that you've received in your heart, allowing that grace to transform you into the image of Jesus, allowing the grace of God to make your treasure the treasure of God, to enlarge yourself on the inside so that your thoughts will no longer limit you or hinder you from the life that God has planned for you to live. You know, most people's worst enemy is not the devil. He's been defeated. He's under our feet. As a matter of fact, he has no authority over the child of God. No authority but deception. It's not other people. It's not the recession. It's not what's happening in the economy. It's not your boss that doesn't like you. The number one thing that neutralizes people in life is what's happening on the inside of their heart, their mind, their thoughts. That's the place where they neutralize themselves before they even step out of their homes. That's the place where no matter what God said, they just can't seem to see themselves in that perfect picture that God has in mind for them. Just like Israel, when God had this perfect dream and this perfect plan for them to bring them into the promised land, they just never could see it. They never could get what God had in mind for them. Every time their thoughts reverted back to their past, they just never quite saw what God saw. Their treasure never became what God had in mind for them. And we know Psalm 78 verse 41, the Bible says they limited the Holy One of Israel. It wasn't Pharaoh that stopped them. As a matter of fact, God delivered them from Egypt with silver and gold, with prosperity, with wealth. God brought them out with a mighty hand. They were poor one day and they were wealthy the next day, because that is what God's desire was for them. But somehow, although God's blessing was there and God's grace was there and God's favor was there, they never took the time. They never took the time. They never took the time to work on the most important thing in their lives, and that is the treasure within. A good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth good things. A spiritual man out of the spiritual treasure of his heart brings forth spiritual things. A negative man out of the negative treasure. A positive man out of the positive treasure. A carnal man out of the carnal treasure. A stingy man out of the stingy treasure. I know people that have money, but they always claim that they have no money. And eventually they end up with no money. Notice that the Bible says what is in your heart.
Okay, so this is really just a short clip of the whole sermon, but I'll give you a quick overview. So, and it's not just one sermon that he has on the law of attraction. It's two sermons that he had. So he starts the sermon explaining that he wants to talk about a powerful law that governs our lives. And then he calls it the law of attraction. And he says, the law of attraction simply says, like attracts like. You attract to yourself who you are. And then he further says, we're creating our own future all the time, whether we like to know it or not. So in the sermons, he claims that every child of God should always live a really prosperous, blessed life, because that is God's highest desire for every single Christian. And then he really goes through a lot of scripture passages, but he also mentioned it in this clip, but in the other sermon, he mentions 3 John 2 as well, which reads, beloved, I pray that all might go well with you and that you may be in good health as it goes well with your soul. Now, he makes an interesting comment after this, because right after he quotes this passage, he says, if you translate that passage literally, it will mean to succeed in financial matters. And then he says, well, accordingly, every Christian has already been blessed to live a great and prosperous life in material wealth. And then he asks his listeners in one point, he asks them the following question, and I'm quoting, how come so many people still falter and fall and live in defeat and just don't live this life that the Bible guarantees? How come? I believe it's very simple. People don't understand this powerful law. And then he goes on describing the working of the law of attraction, and I quote again, whether you know it or not, whether you like it or not, you're attracting things into your life all the time, good or bad, wanted and unwanted. All the time you are sending out a force, a power, an energy that either attracts good things and good people into your life, or it repels good things and good people. And then he says, notice that the Bible says what is in your heart you're attracting into your life all the time, whether you like it or not. You live by the simple law of attraction. All the time you're attracting things into your life, good or bad, wanted or unwanted. So whatever you think about all the time, you're attracting into your life. Whatever you give your energy and whatever you put your focus upon, you're attracting to yourself all the time. I think you, after this, you will sort of understand what the law of attraction is, but we'll still focus on it for a little while. And then he goes through a whole list, a list of possible negative thoughts that you can have. And then he ends like this. If you're thinking those negative thoughts all the time, you're releasing a negative energy from your heart that repels good things from you. It's like you have this invisible shield that repels, and whatever you fear, you begin to bring into your life. This is a very short overview, so I can just encourage you, if you want to know more, go and listen to the whole sermon. It is on YouTube. And I remember when I listened to this, it all sounded very strange to me. So I decided, well, let's look at the roots of this so-called law of attraction. Where does it come from? And this led me to the New Age spirituality. So what on earth is the New Age spirituality? Now, I'm going to quickly give you a couple of traits of the New Age, and then we're going to move on to the law of attraction again. Okay, so first of all, keep in mind the New Age movement or spirituality is not new at all. In fact, one of the scholars who really wrote a lot on the New Age said that he calls it the second oldest religion, the religion of the serpent. Okay, not to scare anybody, but the point he's just making is that the New Age, although it's called new, it's not necessarily new. The second thing is that New Age is very hard to grasp, very hard to identify. It is a very diverse, a very vast movement with many different practices and beliefs. When Ravi Zacharias talks about the New Age spirituality, he says he compares it with a jelly-like substance. So when the moment you think you have it, it just takes on another form and it slips through your fingers. Another very important characteristic of the New Age is that it portrays a growing infiltration of Eastern mysticism into Western culture. Okay, and this, of course, brings a strong syncretism. Syncretism is a mixture of ideas. It brings a strong syncretism of Western and Eastern worldviews to the table. Now, if you think about a movie like Doctor Strange, so he's a brain surgeon, very successful in the West, and he's in a massive car accident. He loses the function of his hands, and then he goes through, but he's desperate, so he wants to go back to work, so he goes through all these different operations. Nothing works, and in the end he ends up in the East in the company of a guru there, and then he overcomes this struggle. But at one point in the movie he goes back to the West, and he bumps into one of his friends, and she asks him, well, where have you been, da da da, and he says, well, when Western medicine failed me, I turned East. So it's a sort of a mystical turn to the East, but you don't want to get rid of the West, so you keep some of the West, and it's just this mixed bag between the East and the West that you find in the New Age movement. Now, the common worldview of a New Age pioneer would be a pantheistic, monistic worldview, which is just a very technical word for saying that all is one, so everything is ultimately just one big reality, and all is God. So this oneness is at the same time divine. A good analogy here might be if you think about a lake with lots of different streams that flows from this lake, just like the water in the stream is of the same substance as the water in the lake, so everything is of the same substance as the divine. And because of that, the New Age pioneers places a strict emphasis on the self, because you are inherently divine. You have some inherent divine aspect. And it's basically an attempt to get rid of a theistic worldview where you have God who is separate from his creation to the divine that is the creation, basically. So that's what happens in the New Age. And then another one that's also interesting is that the New Age really likes to hijack science in order to justify their worldview. And the victim here is usually quantum physics. Now, I don't know enough about that to say anything further. But when you think about this, when you think about the emphasis on the self, which is a big thing in the New Age spirituality, you can understand why something like the law of attraction comes from the New Age. Because what the law of attraction does, it gives every individual the ability to control their own lives down to the finest detail. So why do I say the law of attraction, or the roots of the law of attraction, is in the New Age spirituality? Well, I have a PowerPoint here just to go through the roots of this thing, because that is when I started to investigate the law of attraction, this is where it led me. It all started with a man named Parkhurst Phineas Quimby. I think there's a photo of the guy. He's the founder of the New Thought movement, which is just a forerunner to the modern day New Age spirituality. And he never used the phrase the law of attraction, but he did lay the foundation for a mind cure science. He said, since the mind is the source of all sickness, therefore the mind is also the source of all healing. So if you can just change your thoughts, then you can change your health, basically. And he had an interesting connection with Mary Baker Eddy. Now, I don't know if you know Mary Baker Eddy. She is the founder of the Christian Science cult, which is neither Christian nor scientific. Okay, but she basically claimed that she was healed by Phineas Parkhurst Quimby using his methods. And if you study the history books, you'll see that Mary Baker Eddy actually struggled with bad health her whole life. Okay, so the next person is Helena Blavatsky. Okay, she is the, I think there's a picture as well, she is the founder of the Theosophical Society, or the co-founder of the Theosophical Society. She's the first person who explicitly used the phrase the law of attraction, okay, in a more spiritual, philosophical way. She published a 2-volume book, Isis Unveiled, The Master Key to the Mysteries of Ancient and Modern Science and Theology. And in those volumes, she popularized the law of attraction a little bit. Now, if you read some of her stuff, you'll see that she was heavy into spiritism, which means that you think you're talking to spirits and you're into that idea. And she said she actually called them the upper spirit beings, and she said that her whole life is devoted to the will of the upper spirit beings. Then there were 2 other guys, Prentice Mulford and Ralph Waldo Trine. Okay, you can bring up the next guy as well. They are considered to be the most prolific New Thought writers of their time. And they wrote individually, Thoughts Are Things and In Tune with the Infinite, in which they also talked about the law of attraction and developed the idea even further. And then a very influential man in this whole history was William Walker Atkinson. Okay, he wrote a book called The Law of Attraction in the Thought World, and he was the editor of the New Thought magazine at one stage. And part of his work, besides from popularizing the Law of Attraction, was to try to synthesize the doctrines of reincarnation and karma with Christianity. That was his work was dedicated to that. And then you have Charles Harnell. He was a very successful businessman who wrote the Master Key System. He also claimed that what gave him his success was the Law of Attraction. Then you have Norman Vincent Peale, who wrote The Power of Positive Thinking. And then in our day and age, it is Rhonda Byrne. She is the woman, an Australian woman, who really popularized the idea of the law of attraction on a very big scale when she published her book, The Secret, in 2006. And she had other books as well. I think they're on here. Sorry, there's The Power that she also published afterwards, The Magic, and I think there's one more, The Hero. So she published all these books. And the secret is basically the law of attraction. Okay, so I think you can go on. I read some of these books, but if you go on, I think there's more pictures in the slide. After this, the scene exploded. There you have more money and the law of attraction, the secret law of attraction, the power of intention, total law of attraction, the everything law of attraction book, the science behind the law of attraction, which is written by a physicist who turned into a new age guru and decided to abandon his science and go into this sort of thing. And then he wrote The Secret Behind the Law of Attraction. The Science Behind the Law of Attraction. So there's a lot of different literature on this out there, which all of them will explicitly claim that they are in some sort of new age spirituality camp. That is where they would position themselves. So here is another video from Dr. Bob Proctor, I think. And he features, they made a whole documentary about The Secret, and he features in this documentary. He's also a pretty influential guy. I just want to, if you listen to him and you can remember what Ad Bosov said, then just try to see if you can find some similarities there.
Hello and welcome. I'm Bob Proctor. And I am really proud and very pleased to be part of The Secret. You see, The Secret literally changed my life around 45 years ago. And for the past 38 years, I have traveled all over the world helping people understand The Secret. The law of attraction is always working. You can never escape it. Everything that comes into your life, you're attracting into your life. And you see, as we understand The Secret, then we can sit down and dictate exactly what we want to come into our life. And with absolute certainty, it will arrive. Let's stop and think of who we are, what we are. You see, I said I am Bob Proctor. The truth is I'm not really Bob Proctor. Bob and Proctor are two words. That's my name. But it's not me. I might look at myself and say, this is me. But this isn't Bob Proctor. This isn't me either. You've never heard anybody phone into work and say, body's not coming in today, it's sick. You've never heard anyone say, am hand. We say, my hand, my name, my job. These are things we have, but it's not me. See, I am a soul, a spirit, non-physical, and I live in this physical body. And I have the ability to dictate the vibration that my mind and body will be in. You see, vibration is a law of the universe. This entire universe operates by law. There are no accidents. And vibration decrees the law of vibration that we literally live in an ocean of motion. Absolutely nothing rests. Everything moves. Everything's vibrating at one speed or another. And we can move into a positive or a negative vibration. We use the word feeling to describe the conscious awareness of the vibration we're in. If you hear a person say, I'm not feeling very well, what they're really saying is, I am in a negative vibration. When you hear a person say, I feel so good, what they're really saying is, I'm in a positive vibration. Now, do you know, when you're in a negative vibration, the only energy you can attract to you is like energy. You're going to attract negative situations into your life. When you're in a positive vibration, the only thing you can attract into your life are things that are in harmony with you, positive things. So let's think about this for a moment. Our body is a molecular structure. It's a mass of molecules in a very high speed of vibration. Mind is movement, and body is the manifestation of that movement. You and I have the conscious ability to choose the images that we're going to hold in our mind. We tap into an infinite source of supply, and we choose our thoughts. We can pick up other people's thoughts, or we can originate thoughts. And when we bring those thoughts together, we create ideas. I can create an idea in my mind of myself having anything I want. And then as I take that idea and impress it upon my subconscious mind, which is universal intelligence, I not only affect my body, but I affect this entire universe. Now I know that most of us have such a small picture, a small image of ourselves, that we have a difficult time believing that we would actually affect the entire universe. But we do. Do you know that thought waves are cosmic waves that penetrate all time and space? And when I think something, I control the vibration I'm in. And when I control the vibration I'm in, I control what I attract into my life. If I want greater wealth, I just have to see it coming into my life. I've been given a magnificent imagination. And through the use of my imagination, I can create, originate pictures in my mind. I can see myself in beautiful relationships. I can see myself experiencing wonderful success. I can see money coming to me through multiple sources on a continuous basis. You see, I dictate what I see. Do you know Viktor Frankl was a Jewish psychiatrist that spent the war years in...
I think it's still a long video, so I think we can just stop there. So that's sort of the roots of the law of attraction from within the New Age spirituality. Now, later on, the New Age spirituality gave birth to what is known as the prosperity gospel or the word of faith movement. And the technical name for the law of attraction in the word of faith movement is called positive confession. And the reason why they call the word of faith movement the word of faith movement is because it emphasizes the high value of your words, because and faith at the same time. But first of all, they say that you can speak faith-filled words. Now, if you look at their definition of faith, it's also a little bit different than what I think faith is. But faith to them is, like we would say, we have faith in God. God is the object of our faith. To them, your faith is the object of your faith, because faith becomes something similar to the force that you see in Star Wars, or it's a force that you can direct towards God to, well, manipulate him or equip him to do whatever you want him to do and to give you. So that's basically how this law of attraction was, how it changed when it entered into a Christian flavor. Now, to some extent, it seems that Atbosov also writes about this. I've read his book, Live a Yes Life, and in there he talks about positive confession, explaining that we must change from the negative to the positive, because in the same way our faith can be seen and heard, our unbelief is also very visible and audible. Accordingly, God can only work with the positive or negative power that is within us. Everyone must therefore be careful with their thoughts and words, since God, the angels, and the demons are always listening to our faith or unbelief. The moment we open our mouth to speak, we can invite God into the equation or leave him out of it. If there is a no in our words, God can't intervene on our behalf. And you can go and read his book, but that's what he writes about the positive confession. You must confess positively. So the only difference between a Christian who believes in the law of attraction and a New Age pioneer would be that a Christian still believes in the existence of God, and that they direct this law or this idea with their thoughts, feelings, and words at God, and then God will react to that. While a New Age pioneer don't believe in God, but they would just say that you direct it as the universe as a whole, and the universe then begins to restructure, and then whatever you want, whatever you direct at the universe with your words, thoughts, and so on, the universe will provide a physical manifestation of that. So that is a real quick overview of the roots of the law of attraction. I think, to me, the concern here on a theological level is that God is turned into a vending machine. Okay, what is a vending machine? You know, you throw in money and you pick what you want and you get it. So the money equips the machine to do whatever you want the machine to do, or to give to you whatever you want the machine to give to you. So that is what happens, I think, on a theological level. Okay, so I know up to now it has been a really long point, and I want to make one more point, and then we're going to conclude. The next thing I want to say is that I've spoken with a couple of people who were members in CRC at one point in their lives, and the picture I got from them regarding CRC was not always positive. Now, remember, I'm speaking just here from the data that I gathered from people who I spoke to who were members of CRC at one point in their lives. But the point I'm making is that across the board you get that. And I think that might be something to be concerned about as well. It would involve things like a very rigid approach to church life and theology. Like if you don't, they would sometimes tell people, listen, you have to prioritize. You can't miss Bible study. You can't miss this because of some other priority that you have. You need to really start prioritizing your life, because if you miss Bible study again, then we're not going to think you're that loyal, that good Christian anymore. And that's the, I think that's, it's an application of a very rigid devotion to the church and so on. And then just one last thing, I think it's just important to talk about leadership, because leadership, especially when it comes to churches, I think is crucial. Take Paul, for example. In 1 Corinthians 1 from verse 11, he writes about, he tries to address division in the church, and he says to the people, well, the one guy says, I follow Paul, no, I follow Apollos, I follow Cephas, and I follow Christ. Okay, so Christ is brought down to the level of just one leader amongst other church leaders of that time. That is how it happened. And then Paul says, is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Or were you baptized in the name of Paul? And then listen to this. He says, I thank God that I baptized none of you except Crispus and Gaius, so that none of you may say that you were baptized in my name. This is the one person who I think can really say, I'm the leader of this church, who has the kind of authority to do that, and yet he says, no. You don't do that. You don't claim that kind of authority over a church, because in the end of the day, Christ is not divided. We follow Christ. So I think it just boils down to a very basic question. Who are you following on an ultimate scale? Are you following the Pope? Are you following Ray McCauley? Are you following Atbosov? Whoever are you following? Or are you following Christ? And I think to me, that is just a point to make, because what I have seen is a trend on Facebook and so on. People really want to have a picture with Atbosov. Now, remember, this critique is only valid as long as the shoe fits. So that doesn't mean everybody is here. But is in that position. But I think some people really just... Ut gets a position that I don't think he should have in the lives of some members. All right. I'm going to conclude, and what I want to end with is just to share a couple of thoughts from one of my favorite writers, Os Guinness. And he wrote a book, Dining with the Devil, which was a critique on the megachurch movement of that is prominent around the world today. And this is not so much a critique against CRC. This is just in general some comments which I think is really valuable to any church to take note of this. And he talks about a lot about the influence of modernity on the church, and he mentions that in one sense the mega church movement or mega churches is a good thing, but on another level it can really be dangerous. And he gives a couple of valuable things. So first of all, he says, have a balanced view or a balanced understanding between quantity and quality in the church. And I think this is really relevant for big churches, because you can go after quantity at the cost of quality. Okay, and Os Guinness warns against that, and he mentions Charles Spurgeon as an example. Now, if you don't remember Charles Spurgeon or you don't know who he was a preacher. He was known as the Prince of Preachers, and he had a very large church. 10,000 members on a Sunday would attend his church. But go and read his sermons. it's difficult to read some of them, but it's the theological depth is there, and I think it's he really managed to have a very balanced view between quantity and quality. So there's a risk there. Secondly, make sure that theology remains central and not methodology. Make sure that theology remains at the center and not methodology. And the one example is that sometimes worship and discipleship is placed in a position of subordination to evangelism. And then sometimes all three of them are subordinated to entertainment. Okay, so he warns against the kind of methods that you use there. Thirdly, churches shouldn't lose a sense of historical awareness. And the reason he says this is because if you really go and read some church history, you would be up to date with some of the major trends that happened in the church, and you will also be better prepared for possible extremes, possible pitfalls, and so on. So he encourages people to read some church history, and also if you look at the trends within the churches the last century, he mentions the following. He says the trends are the following. It is from theology to experience, from truth to technique, from elites to populism, and from an emphasis on serving God to an emphasis on serving the self in serving God. It's interesting trends that he mentions. Fourthly, it is sometimes easy to compromise on things for the sake of relevance. And then he mentions 1 Corinthians 9, Paul, where he says, I have become all things to all men so that by all possible means I might save some. Now, I think the balance here is also formulated in I shouldn't confuse myself here now. Be in the world but not of it. Okay, I was just scared I say it the wrong way. Be in the world but not of the world. The church father Origen explained it as following, where he was referring to Exodus. He taught that Christians are free to plunder the Egyptians, but forbidden to set up a golden calf from the spoils. You're in the world, not of the world. You're no longer the person you have been before Christ, before you met Christ, but you're not yet someone who knows Christ fully. And then he adds, you're free to utilize, but forbidden to idolize. So all these contrasts expresses the critical tension with the world that we are required to maintain as churches. And this tension, he goes further, he says, this tension is simultaneously a sign of obedience and a source of strength to the church. And then my last point, which I decided to also mention, and I think it's the most important one, is in the church of God, we let God be God. And therefore, the church is only the church when she lives and thrives finally by God's truths and God's resources. And I think the biggest truth and the biggest resource he gave his church is the death and resurrection of his son. That is where the church stands or falls. And that is not just where the church stands or falls. That is where each individual Christian, that is where you stand or fall at the cross of Jesus. Thank you. I think that is all from my side. I don't know if there's time for questions. I guess there is always time for questions at the Alua.
So, obviously, positive thinking and negative thinking can still be something that we use in the church. And if you think of scriptures like, you know, think on whatever is noble, whatever is true, whatever is good, and also, I mean, Jesus made the point that if you've thought something that's bad, it's as if you've already done it. So it's not that far-fetched to think that Christians need to consider our thoughts and how we manage that. And I mean, who's that lady who's got the book Battlefield of the Mind, where you either entertain the devil who's telling you lies about yourself or you trust in what the Bible says about you, and that's a lot about identity. So what I think I'm hearing you say in between the lines is that when we start using those thoughts for what we can get or not get, or how much power we can execute in a miracle situation, or what we, then it becomes problematic. But for righteousness and for Christian living, positive thinking is okay, but not when it starts becoming a thing of what we can get with it.
Yeah, I think I should have actually made the distinction. I usually do. I just forgot to do that tonight. But it's good that you brought that up, because I think we have to make a distinction between positive thinking as just a way of life, as just being positive about your life, about the hope that you have, and all these kind of things. While I think in the context that I mentioned, it is more that you think you can manipulate reality with your thoughts. And also, you think that, because remember, if the law of attraction is true, if it really works that way, if that is the way that God wants the universe to function, then what's the logical conclusion if you're in an accident tomorrow? You brought that upon yourself with your thoughts and your emotions and your words, maybe. So I think that, to me, is where I draw the line. I have no problem with people who want to be positive. In fact, I think as Christians, everybody should be positive. But I don't buy into an idea where you think that if you have positive thoughts and you think about money, things you want and desire, then you will have a physical manifestation of that. That is where I think I draw the line. And vice versa, if you have negative thoughts, then that will also come over your life. So thank you. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I actually came prepared with, because I know C.R. Shewald, I actually came prepared with some questions. However, throughout the presentation, I shifted my thought, and I'm going to skip those two. And I want to ask, very much in line with what Lorraine asked, because my thought of the week was, you know, our hearts are deceitful above all things. And with your recommendation, I mean, this is not perhaps particular to CRC, but how do we manage our hearts in terms of Christian living? If we feel depressed, or should we just start praying or do negative things, how do we manage our hearts? Because, you know, we can't trust our hearts. So that's a difficult one.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good question. Yeah, look, it's difficult to answer for you. But I'll answer more for myself. First of all, I think when the Bible talks about heart, it has a very significant deep meaning in the Old Testament as well as the New. You have it refers to like the innermost being of who you are. That's your heart when the New Testament talks about that. So when we have the mandate then to guard our hearts and protect our hearts, it's a pretty huge thing. So I'm reminded now of 1 Peter 3, verse 15, which is also the verse for the apologetic mandate, to be apologists. But just prior to that, you read, sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts. And I think that's where you start. If you want to protect your heart, sanctify Christ as Lord of your heart. Make him the Lord of your life, because that's basically what it says. And of course, it's not. You can do it the one day; the next day, it's not there. But yeah, well, other than that, I think really there's disciplines, things that I mean, we were on a camp where we learned a lot about rhythms. Yeah, you were there. So I mean, if you really, I think, put in some effort to make that rhythms part of your life, that's also a way to guard your heart against deception, against temptations and so on. So, yeah, I think, you know, things like praying and so on. But it's always a very beautiful verse to me, sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts.
Anything else?
In my own journey with my personal thoughts and things was the presence of grace in your life. Because not only knowing that Jesus has grace with you, but you should have grace with yourself as well. In that, you know, you're in a good place and you have your rhythm and all of that. But then when you fail, you sometimes, like, when you start to slope, you really like to slope. So when you start to slope, you know that God is there and he has grace with you, and you should have that kind of grace with yourself as well. Just a side note that was for me.
Thanks.
Daniel, I'm not sure if you
if you have something to say, but in my experience with a lot of CRC guys, and again, I appreciate the fact that you've got a lot of appreciation for a lot of the ministry that they do, a lot of zeal, but the one thing that I've noticed is a big thing about authority. Authority is very important, and the authority, and this is a very... this is an observation from the pavilion, so I cannot say that this is what's happening, but it does seem that they are very big on authority, and you're not allowed to teach unless you've gone through this system, and then obviously Ut is at the top in terms of what authority is. He very much speaks from the chair, yeah. It would seem. And... I mean, that raises some concerns, and also I hope and I think that they would agree that salvation is definitely outside of CRC as well. I would sincerely hope that. But they, although they believe that salvation is outside of CRC, they would really encourage you to come get salvation inside CRC. It's a better version. I don't know. I mean, that's a bit facetious, but... I'm not sure if you have anything to comment on that. That's at least, in as much as we're talking about vibrations, that is a vibe that I picked up.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I think that's why I have issues with a hierarchical church structure where the local church loses its own right as being a church, because I mean the Roman Catholic Church works to a certain extent the same way. You have the Pope, although I think there will be huge differences between the Catholic Church and CRC. So what I've picked it up. Ut Boshoff is pretty much at the top of the structure. He has influence over all the major decisions down to a local level as well. And you'll hear a lot of local church pastors of CRC churches who calls him their spiritual father. Now, there's in principle nothing wrong with that, because Paul calls Timothy spiritual son. So in principle, there's nothing wrong with doing that, but I do think that it can become an unhealthy situation if you buy into the authority of one man who's not directly involved with your local church, not involved there in the church, and just sits somewhere and he's broadcasting his messages to all the other local churches. I think there's potential problems there. And then if you go back to the Reformation, I think that is one of the things that they did, is the reformers said, no, each believer, each Christian... has the service of a prophet, priest, and a king. It was usually limited within Roman Catholicism to certain people, like you mentioned. Maybe with the CRC, you have to go through this and before. So the Reformation freed us from something like that, similar to that, maybe, to say no. Each individual are allowed to evangelize, or allowed to do a devotion out of scripture, are allowed to pray on his or her own in their own room. So yeah, it's just a couple of comments that I can share.
Well, I've personally been involved with CRC for quite a number of years. I've led quite a number of students back at the University of the Free State. I have friends whom I personally led to the Lord who are pastors there at CRC, and if there's something that I honestly have to emphasize, is that Pastor Art's style of leadership is very autocratic. You know, there's no room for even a cordial dissent, if that exists. It's a wild machine, you know. But like you were saying earlier on, as much as there's a few critical points that are of a concern about CRC, one cannot question his organizational skills. Pastor Ayed, he's an amazing organizer. You know, world-class infrastructure, I have to say, is one thing that I've always, you know, envied. But it's personally, I feel it comes at an expense of the quality that you alluded. So I have first-hand experience with CLC, and I felt I thought you were going to go deeper, you know, in terms of the clinical analysis of CRC. Their theology, it's honestly speaking, it's quite worrisome. That's my personal opinion.
No, thank you. I think I can agree with you, but I do want to mention let me just make this clarification quickly. Like I said, the agreements to me is primary, although I'm also worried. I mean, I expressed my concern regarding the New Age infiltration of CRC. But I do think, and as far as I know, as far as I know, they do affirm the essentials of the Christian faith. Now, of course, the things around that we can legitimately be concerned about that as well, and I am, but I'm not so concerned about you know, them earning a label cult. I'm not there.
This is great, and I appreciate the fact that you started by saying, you know, they're in the house. The analogy that you gave, the things. You just said it now. The things that we can all amen as Christians.
Sorry,
there we go. Sorry, I was in my inner voice there. I'm really sorry. So what if someone was to come to you and this? Feel free to not answer this or to go. Hey, I'd love to talk to you privately about that. But if someone was to come to you, a family member or a colleague or a neighbor. And they said, "Hey, I'm thinking about joining CRC. What would you say to them? And then what? How would you unpack whatever the answer is? Like, how would you unpack that? So, for example, if we went with the New Age to explain all of that to the everyday person, you can get lost in a lot of things. So I guess that's my question: is if someone came and said, "Hey, I appreciate while you go, hey, no, they're not. You're not going to call them a cult." But without causing division, if I'm going to say no, what do I say? And if I do say yes, well, what are those reasons for saying I'm happy for you to go there?
Yeah, that's a good question, although it's a bit difficult. I'll try my best to make some comments. I think, obviously, it's going to be an individual conversation with a unique individual. So I'll ask some questions. What do they want in a church? What's some of the things that they think they'll get at CRC they won't get at another church? So I think I'll dig a little bit into their expectations of what a church is to them. And then I think as you ask some of these questions and you have some knowledge on CRC, for example, then I'll probably advise them, listen, here's my concerns. I'll be honest about my concerns. And if that doesn't, if they're not persuaded by my concerns, then I won't be worried about them if they go there. Although I will still have a friendship there. I'll try to really stay connected with the person and do some follow-ups maybe. You know, how is it going there? Are you still happy there? Is this what you expected? And then maybe if an idea comes up that I think is concerning, then I'll be honest again. So it's a difficult thing because I don't like I don't like questions. What should you do? It's sometimes difficult to answer the what should you do questions. But yeah, so I think I should. You're supposed to at least be honest with them about concerns that you might have. And if they're not persuaded by that, then they are free to go. But I'll do follow-up. Yeah, I think so.
Maybe just to add to Humpo and Onay's question, So you mentioned the law of attraction. That's a concern you have. You mentioned the hierarchical structure that is a bit rigid, and it can lead to sort of a cult personality. That doesn't mean you're a cult. It just means that a cult personality, it can be a bit dangerous. Are there any other things that you'll flag?
It's difficult to do that on a theoretical level, because they don't give you a lot to work with on their statement of faith and so on. So it's difficult to work with that. For example, if I compare that to Christ in Me International, who's definitely a cult, they give you a lot to work with, at least. They give me extensive statement of faiths on their website, positions that they have on the Trinity and the deity of Jesus. So that helps. But the CRC doesn't do that. But I think you pointed at something now. You can make a distinction, you can legitimately make a distinction between a cult and something being cultic. That's not the same thing. A church might be theologically sound, but they still have cultic tendencies. Because if you define a cult from, you can define a cult from sociology or psychology, and also from theology and a doctrinal analysis. So although a church like CRC might not present a theological deviations that earns the label cult, they might have cultic tendencies from a psychological or a sociological level. That's where the hierarchy comes in, and then they talk about control mechanisms. I mean, you can control people's thoughts, emotions. You can control their behavior and their norms, their schedules. So there's ways a church can be unhealthy and be cultic, but not necessarily a cult.
I think I'm going to stop with that. It doesn't look like any of you guys have a burning question. Thank you, Daniel. And if you want to engage a little bit more with Daniel, you're more than welcome to do that afterwards. His wife is out of town, so he's got nothing to do tonight. And then I just want to reiterate this. So Daniel is a very careful guy. I'm not sure if you picked it up. To Humpo's annoyance, not saying enough, but something that we need to stress here is that for so long, the way that we've dealt with, especially in the area of social media, we try to scapegoat, we try to villainize. And I really appreciate the fact, Daniel, that you tried your best to stay away from that. Let's really try to critically engage, lovingly engage. And I mean, we would be really struggling to live up to our name of dialogue if we do not do that within a safe environment. And I also really hope that this podcast can get out there and people can start to have this conversation. And again, if you are in CRC and you didn't want to put up your hand, then please see this as a conversation starter. And we would like to learn more from you and not as a final judgment from our side. Thank you, Daniel, and thank you, guys, and have a good week. There's coffee outside.